It is Wednesday, my dudes, and that means it is time for another episode of Codex Radio. It is Wednesday, May 30th, 2018, and that means it is time for episode 21, which is part 9 of our reading of Planescape Torment. I apologize because this episode is a little bit late. It's still coming out today, but I have to confess that Memorial Day giving us a 3-day weekend kind of messed up my posting schedule and left me a little confused. So apologies for that, but we're still getting it out. We've got a great episode for you today. We get into some business with Dakon that I'm very excited for and make some serious headway in getting nearer to Ferret. So I think we're just about done with the Hive side quests bit of the story and are on the cusp of advancing the plot in some serious material way. So, yeah, I think that's all I've got to say up front. Let's get to it. I give you part 9 of Planescape Torment. Chapter 26. The next day in Ragpicker Square brought with it a malodorous encounter, the likes of which I'd never experienced. Now, the Hive was far from being all blossoms and daisies. The air had a sulfurous char to it, thickened with the grating smell of burned oil and sour, unwashed flesh. The Hive was the festering wound of Sigil, decaying so that it was collapsing in on itself despite the efforts of the Dabas to stitch it together. The smell was of rankled pus of the city, moldering beneath a dirty bandage. But this... Dakon, in his quiet, cool manner, had recommended that we ask the slummier characters in Sigil about Ferid. "One must know the ways of a rat to find another." Dakon was smooth, yet iron-hard. A sword sheathed in silk. A man had squirreled himself into a corner, glancing furtively at the passerby. The man was looking at us with a strange, bug-eyed stare. His eyes were huge, so huge that they looked ready to pop out of its sockets and roll across the cobblestones. He nodded eagerly as we approached, bobbing his head like a bird. As we neared him, we were suddenly greeted with the smell of urine and feces. I could have cut it with a knife and buttered my toast with it. I tried not to breathe through my nose. "Greetings." "Pah," Mort spat. "Sometimes I think you relish in wallowing about this tripe, Chief. This guy smells worse than a burst boil on a fiend's arse." I breathed in short puffs. It helped a bit. "You don't have a nose, Mort. How can you smell anything?" Mort spat again, gagging. "Chief, I can taste it." The man sniffled, wiping his nose on his sleeve, and then opened his mouth to reveal blackened, rotted gums. "Stories for coin, sirrah." His breath reeked. It smelled like this man had been keeping rotten meat stored inside his mouth. "Stories for coin." I took a step back. "Who are you?" The man snorted, thick with phlegm. "Names, names. Who you are, who you are." His head twitched slightly every time he repeated himself. "Names. Dangerous. Dangerous." He glanced at the ground and stirred the dirt with his foot. "Dangerous? Knowing a name or being stuck with one, both a mess of trouble." He looked back up at me. "My name's a given name, not one asked for. Reekwind." Once again, I become conscious of his reeking breath and the smell of urine and feces that surrounded him. "A given name, a given name." I glanced at Dakon, who stared ahead placidly. The smell seemed to bother him little. "Reekwind, huh? Is that your real name?" "Not my true name, true name," Reekwind mumbled on, his head twitching every time he said the word name. "A true name's a dangerous thing. Gives others power." He stared at me with his huge eyes and wagged his finger. "Keep your name secret. Keep it close. Never let it out." "What do you mean?" Names are like smells. Things can track you with them. Requin coughed, his eyes almost popping out of his skull as he did so. His cough seemed to loosen his bowels, and he broke wind loudly as if to accentuate his point. If someone knows a true name, it gives him power. He licked his lips. Power to hurt. A chill ran up my spine. Was this, I wondered, why I remained nameless? I should have taken Requin's words with a grain of salt. The words of an addled vagrant meant little, but in a city of addled vagrants, Requin's words cut deep. I don't know my true name. Requin's eyes widened. Seeing his eyeballs bulge even larger made me even more uneasy. Then you are blessed, blessed. Remain nameless, and you shall be as a spirit on the plains, untraceable, untrackable, unseen, undiscovered. He smacked his gums wetly. A name chosen, a name given, allows others to find you and hurt you. A shudder ran through me, a vestigial fear, perhaps, of a long-forgotten terror that might have hunted me, something I might have escaped from by casting my name into the lots of oblivion. Have you been hurt? Requind gave a twitching nod, then scratched himself. Let my name slip once, once, only once, only once. His eyes filmed over as if the memory was painful before glancing at me uneasily. Tell you the story I can, I will, but three coppers must I see. His face split into a smile at the word coppers, and his reeking breath hit like a hammer. My coin pouch was full enough. Very well. Here's three coppers. Requind got into a stance, looked left, looked right, then faced me. His face clenched, then, with a grunt, he broke wind again. The smell nearly leveled me, but he took no notice. Cursed, I. Walking the wards in splendor. He stood up stiffly, nose high in the air. Requin sauntered back and forth, nodding to invisible passerby. Then Requin froze, his arms akimbo. Crossed paths with a crossed one. Had the looking of a pumpkin. His seeds, curses. Requin then thrust his belly out so as to appear fat, and slicked his hair back with his filthy palm so he looked almost bald, and began drumming his fingers on his fat belly. He then walked around, circling the spot where his stuffy upper-class persona used to be. All a jumble with curses, this one was. With a sneer and a careless gesture, Requin tossed an invisible curse at the stuffy persona. Knew my name, let it slip I had. All it took it all. He stiffened up again, inhaling deeply and resuming his upper-class persona. The persona suddenly crumpled, and Requin broke wind violently, then exhaled, filling the air with his foul, reeking breath. Cursed with stenches, smells, excrement. Came here to tell tales. All good for now. Now Requin is the name. Given name. Poor sod. I tapped my chin with one finger. Can you tell me where I could find someone named Farid? Requin suddenly hunched over and leered at me. He walked around me for a moment, dragging his leg as if lame. A king! A noble tale! Noble tale! A tale I can tell, but three coppers must I see. The coppers clinked humbly into his palm. Requin remained hunched over, staring. Once a man of respect, Farid was. A man of goals and position. All became nothing. Nothing. Turned to air. Requin squinted, then broke wind, filling the air with a gut-churning smell. Turned to air and stink. A liar, a cheater, a man who twisted law, Farid was. He hunched over as if writing at a desk. He wrote for a moment and then suddenly stopped, afraid. Then one day, he found that he had twisted himself. Such a liar he had become that when he died he was to go to a horrible place. Requin shook his head sadly, then hunched over again and looked wildly in all directions. Farid would not accept it, would not. He had cheated others, he would cheat his fate too. He read, dug in books, consulted seers. Requin stalked back and forth, his hand over his eyes as if staring off into the distance. And they told him, that only in trash could he find that which would let him cheat his fate. Requin broke wind again, then gave a reeking cough. Perhaps they lied. Requin stood up stiffly, then began to fling off imaginary clothes. With every piece of clothing he threw away, he became more hunched. Farad threw away his position, his goals, and took up a new title. Requin stopped, then leered at me. He clawed at his rags, shaking them. And he became a king of rags. He would rule the trash, have his subjects search it all, and find that which he needed. He shook his head. He looks even now. Even now. Wow. Sigil ground the high and mighty into the dust like a millstone. Do you know where I could find him? Requin shook his head. He live amongst the rags and trash. There you will find him. Find him. The drone of flies replaced the cacophony of the hive masses. One squelched under my hand as I slapped it from my neck, leaving a biting pain and an itch where it had landed. With all the strange things in Sigil I'd seen the past few weeks, I wouldn't be surprised if these things were demon spawn from the seventh layer of the abyss or the like. Meandering cautiously through the piles of trash, one thing looked promising. A wooden walkway, hidden in a nook behind the huts and the filth. I had only noticed it out of the corner of my eye as we dug through a mundane little region previously unexplored. It was a place you wouldn't have given a second thought to. The perfect site for the entrance of a hermit like Farad. With the boards creaking under our boots, though, things became less revealing and more mundane. Garbage was piled high on either side. Some of it was fresh, bones with scraps of moist flesh, half-filled jars whose contents still held some color and were yet to be touched by the mold and mildew. Now and again I saw the corpse of a cranium rat, the flies just beginning to gather. This must have been a walkway for wheelbarrows, so more trash could be dumped aside. I looked around cautiously. This was a city where its citizens fought over corpses and thugs lurked at every corner. I wouldn't have been surprised if the scavengers of this square hid amongst the filth and refuse so they could pounce on any unsuspecting, naive explorer. Funneled down this narrow walkway, it would have been a simple matter to outflank the three of us. But nothing came of it. At the end of the path, an archway led only inches into a small building before becoming blocked by a solid wall of refuse. The rubbish was packed so tightly it may as well have been stones and mortar. Mort piped up. "Hold up, Chief. Look at this." Peering down, I noticed a number of dirty footprints that led into the archway, and didn't turn around. "There must be a portal through here or something." "A portal? How do we open it?" "Haven't the slightest, Chief. It's gotta be a common key, though. Look at all the traffic that's gone through. Maybe one of the lowlives around here will know." Leaving was quicker than entering, and much more pleasant. How Farad, once a nobleman or official of Sigil, could bear living in these environs was beyond my imagination. A weaselly-looking fellow was skulking about the garbage like a tattered shadow. Seeing me and Mort, he beckoned to me.
"Hey, the skull! Where you get the skull, eh? Me skull it is! Give it back to me!"
Mort turned to the hiver.
"Pike off!"
I, however, was more curious about this fellow. "Who are you?" He ignored me, still staring at Mort.
"Skull's mine! Mine, eh? Give it to me! I'll forget you stole it!"
He mumbled, his narrowed eyes darting. I was getting rather annoyed with this fellow, and decided to let him find it out for himself. "Go on, take the skull." As if there was any chance he would be able to. He chuckled dryly and smiled. As he reached for Mort, there was a snap, and the man's hand whipped back. The man began screaming.
"Ugh! Ugh! I'll kill you! Kill you!"
Mort was holding one of the man's fingers between his teeth like some sort of macabre cigar. He spoke around the finger.
"Touch me again, and your hand's gonna join your finger, Burke."
"Mort, give the man back his finger." Mort spat the finger at the man. It bounced off his chest and fell to the ground. No need to waste any more time here. That's a hard lesson learned. Farewell. The man, biting his lip from the pain, glared at me. Suddenly, he attacked. He was no match for Mort and myself, and folded almost immediately with a wound from my knife in his belly. I noticed Dakon, who had been silently watching, had joined in my defense. I considered asking Dakon what he thought of my actions, but I was apprehensive that I might find out he didn't approve. I noted for later consideration that his mere presence seemed to be having an effect on me. Another man had been watching the fight. He was now whistling a cheerful tune and playing with a well-kept fighting knife. As I approached him, he stopped whistling and gave me a curious look. "Greetings." As I spoke, he whirled and dropped into a half-crouch, though whether he was ready to spring at me or in some other direction, I couldn't tell. Dakon rested one hand calmly on his blade as the squirrely little fellow spoke.
"What? Speak quick now."
I had some questions.
"Well, I don't got answers. Pike off."
I hadn't noticed it before, but he had a long, curved dagger in his hand. I crossed my arms and made my voice level.
"Are you threatening me?"
He smirked.
"Why? Does Ratbone scare you? You feeling threatened, Burke?"
"No, I'm not," I said, my gaze boring into his. I'd be damned if I was going to bloody my hands any more today.
"Heh, figures, looking the way you do. All right, what you want from me?"
I looked the man up and down. "Who are you?"
"My name's Ratbone, Cutter. I'm a thief for hire in the employ of old Sharegrave, boss of the collectors you see round the square. Pays me to learn his lads to be real quiet-like and how to fight if they runs into a spot of trouble. That's likely the only questions I'll answer for you, Cutter."
He sniffed and shrugged. I relaxed. "Thief for hire? Could you train me?" He nodded and pursed his lips.
"Sure, for a spot of jink. Been trained before?"
"No, I haven't."
"That's fine. I'm gonna cuff you now, so dodge it."
He suddenly swung his open hand at my head, and I leapt back just in time. He gave a nod of approval.
"Not bad, Cutter. Now about that spot of jink. 50 commons, and I'll see you train right up."
"Sounds good. Here." The coins clinked thickly into his palm. I had already spent too many hours and done too many jogs between Mebus Hut and the marketplace for training, but Ratbone made things short and sweet. His lessons on the basics of thievery were detailed, but I found myself picking up the subtle nuances of the trade rather quickly. The stances and techniques were oddly familiar, like the handshake of an old friend. After a long period of training, Ratbone nodded at me in satisfaction.
"I must say, Cutter, never have I run across a faster learner. I'd almost say you've done this all before."
I dusted off my hands. A good set of skills if I ever needed it, but for now, Majory would probably help a bit more. "Thanks, Ratbone," I said, and pointed back to the archway. "Do you know how to get through that trash-packed archway northwest of here?" Ratbone blinked.
"Eh? Nay, I don't. Say, he has Creedon the Ratcatcher. Sometimes he goes poking about up there and disappears for an odd while. Creedon's usually in the Ive, right outside the Office of Vermin and Disease Control." "Oi there, Cutter. Well met again. Have you changed your mind? Come back for one of Creedon's delicious ratsies?"
Creedon piped as he jangled his rat pole enticingly.
"No, not today. I
had some questions, however." He shouldered his rat pole casually.
"What's your question, Cutter?"
"I was told to ask you about the trash-filled archway in Ragpicker's Square. Can you help me?" He thought for a moment.
I know what you're speaking of. There was a lass named Nails who I saw walk through there once while I was looking for rats. Don't know how she did it, though. You could probably find her northeast of here, rooting around a pile of lumber for nails and the like."
I nodded. "Thanks, Creedon. I really appreciate it." He touched my arm.
"I see you're leaving, Cutter, but before you go, would you like a nice delicious ratsy? One for the road, you might say."
I winced. Might as well thank him for his help. "Why not?" Creedon grinned from ear to ear.
"Good, Cutter, good. What sort of ratsy would you like?"
He pointed to each in turn with a grimy fingernail.
"I got 'em baked, spiced, boiled, and charred, all fresh, all scrumptious, and only 3 cobbles for 2.
Spiced. Maybe that might cover up whatever odd aftertaste there was. I handed over the coppers, and in one swift motion, he ran a pair of spiced rats through a wooden skewer, unhooked them, and placed them in my hand. I let up a small prayer that he didn't handle them with his grubby fingers. Creedon winked at me.
Enjoy, Cutta.
I don't suppose you want one, Mort? I asked, handing the other skewer to Dakon. He accepted it silently and dug in calmly.
You really love taking me past my comfort zone, don't you, Chief?
The rat meat was aromatic and quite spicy. Apparently marinated in some sort of herbal mixture before being cooked. It was a bit greasy and rather rich, tasting of some other meat that I was sure I had had before. The man looked at me expectantly.
Did you like? Would you like another?
I picked a few scraps of meat from the ribcage. No thanks. We should be going. Iron Nails was right where I left her. Gripping a nail with a calloused thumb and bracing against the board with her foot, she yanked the thing out with one pull. By the look of her burly shoulders, she could have knocked out a few teeth on the backswing if I had been standing behind her. Hello, Nails. Iron Nails straightened up and put her hands on her hips.
Back again, eh? What do you need this time?
I was told to ask for you about the trash-filled archway in Ragpicker Square. Can you help me? Nails nodded slowly.
It's a portal, you know. Stumbled on it quite by chance, I did. All you need to do is to have a handful of junk on you when you walked up to it, and you'll be able to pass right through. There's a small open space past the portal and a gate leading underground, but I figured no sense in asking for trouble, so I just turned around and went right back.
Here. She handed me a handful of junk. Use this if you like. I was going to toss it away anyhow. It was a few hours after peak when we returned, and the heat of the day made the garbage molder, belching up a vile stench. I covered my nose and tried to filter the air through my teeth, but it left a greasy feeling in my mouth. Now and again I spat, and a few times the wad would sizzle and hit metal cooked by the afternoon heat. With the decay quickening around me, I glanced back and forth. Not even Requind would have buried himself and hidden in this rot, though it might have improved his own stench. No, I was listening for the groans and the creaks of a pile that might collapse and bury me in its foul grime and juices. As I approached the archway, its outline began to shimmer. The junk in my hand pulsed, shimmering as well. The two auras pulsed against one another like a slow heartbeat in blue-white throbs and flickers of pale sparks. I thrust the junk into the archway. The wall of refuse flickered, wavered, and seemed to fold in on itself. With a familiar whoosh, the portal opened, revealing a space beyond it. That rat Ferret better have my journal. I stepped through. Interlude. Idly, Audolin Averis plucks the strings of his lyre. A languid tune, sweet with regret and bitter with his unfulfilled joy, keeps the crowd shifting in their stools in an uneasy silence. You sop up the last few smudges of gravy with the last bite of a roll and pluck the last tender mushroom from your plate. The fare was a bit saltier than you had expected, but still, it's hard to find a meal this fine in the hive. Better than stewed cranium rats, certainly.
Well?
Gamir's gruff voice breaks the silence. The little firebrand had hopped on his stool once again.
Get on with it!
Audolin clears his throat and flushes gold with embarrassment. I must confess, good gents, that this was the final chapter of the journal. Only a few blank pages remain, and though I have consulted many a seer and scryer, nothing remains of the rest of his tale in this humble tome. The snarls of the crowd could only be expected, but still you reel back and take up a defensive stance when the mismatched throngs set off pounding tables and throwing mugs. Feral beastmen reveal their claws and demons snarl, huffing fire and smoke as eyes redden with fury. You only hope that no one is foolish enough to pull a dagger. Once steel is drawn in a crowded bar, the only thing left is a mass slaughter and some new bodies to warm the beds of the prisons for the mercy killers. Indeed, steel is drawn, but not by one of the unwashed rabble. Shara Sixblades draws a gleamed curved sword from under the counter and, with a hefty swing, spears it 6 inches deep into the surface. With the ear-splitting crunch of wood against steel, 100 pairs of eyes turned to face a stone-faced Merilith, drawing out another 2 sickle-curved blades. Even the uppity Gamir seems to be thinking twice before starting anything. Shara purses her lips and nods in satisfaction at the ensuing silence, like a stern den mother quieting her unruly children. With one taloned hand, she points to the diva. "Master Avaris, you've performed well in this tavern for as long as I've known you, but this is the first that I've seen you act so crass as to leave a tale unfinished. Do you care to explain yourself?" With a smile of supernatural calm, the bard fingers his lyre and steps gingerly among the shards of shattered mugs at his feet. With a silver smile and a polite bow, he addresses the crowd. "Apologies, Mr. Shara, good sirs and ladies, but the power is not within me to continue this tale. However..." Again, he pauses for emphasis, and 100 craning necks lean towards him.
"Just get on with it,"
a voice snarls from the back of the bar. Audolin coughs. "Ahem. Tales of the Nameless One have been scattered throughout the plains in the years since his legend was flesh. Some are dying echoes, 100 times removed from the original source. Some," he gestures to the journal perched next to his seat, "are left as his true legacy, scribed memories fresh with his experiences and heavy with the corporeality of truth." He leans over to take his chalice of tawny golden wine, still standing after the crowd's fury. The room simmers as he takes a delicate sip, enigmatic eyes glancing over the rim of the glass. "It was said that the Nameless One drew suffering to him as a lodestone draws shavings of iron. The same can be said about that which bears his mark." The crowd whispers as Audolin sets the glass on his stool and scans the crowd. "By beginning this telling, I believe events have already been set in motion to draw the story to us. It is my hope that perhaps another might be able to pick up the tale." The crowd shifts uncomfortably. Winged demons glance suspiciously at fire elementals. Githyanki snarl at their calmer, meditative brethren. A shaman decked in 100 rattling bones and strips of fur breathes, and the air ripples in front of him in patterns that might have been of running stags. Just when Adeline begins to scratch his hair, suddenly nervous, Sai Tavakis dusts off her leather breeches, balances her obsidian-tipped spear over one shoulder, and stands. You lean back in an attempt to avoid getting poked in the eye by the glassy, blood-stained tip, but Sai Tavakis holds herself with expert grace and a keen awareness of those around her. You feel that if she had to, the woman could have danced the spaces between raindrops. "Aye, well, it seems I may have to speak after all." Though Audolin still attempts to keep himself dignified, you notice his lips part in the slightest sigh of relief. He smiles, bows, and retreats from the stage as the elven woman steps up. With a harsh snap of her fingers, she points at a plump barmaid who gasps and scurries off to fetch her a drink. "I care little for telling tales. Words do little to fill bellies, and tomes are of small worth in trade. But when you race the desert winds of my world for 3 full days under a dying red sun, respite with good company and the sharing of stories is a good way to fill a still night." When the wench returns, Sai snatches up the mug and tilts her head back to down the ale in one clean go. Not a drop spills from her lips. Sighing contentedly, she sets the mug down and fishes about in her belt pouch as she speaks. "I had little idea when I was crawling through the Ankheg's burrow that the oaths I muttered would bring me to such strange lands. A city with a sorceress more powerful than any other, and many times more dangerous. These plains are lands to be wary of, but they are still lands fat with water." She smiles as she pulls out a small cube. "In time I took odd jobs here and about, fetching this for a wizard, that for a sage. I stole an enchanted hourglass that told time in blood for one magus, then assassinated him for the very rival I stole it from." For one who had no taste for storytelling, Sai Tavakis was more than proficient. A tilt of the head accompanied every sly word, and sharp blue eyes glinted mischievously with her dark confession. "I had spent 3 weeks in a verdant grove, searching for a strange puzzle box for an aged sorcerer. I found it in a long-abandoned den, buried under age-old bedding of straw and twigs. When I returned to claim my prize, it turned out that the old man had died in his sleep. I kept the box for payment, and as a reminder to claim at least part of the reward for my work beforehand in the future. At the time, I had thought it was some odd, meaningless trinket. Over time, however, I began tinkering with it. A press here, a twist there. Some runes would seem to shift along the carved stone, while others remained in place. Soon I became entranced, toying with it at night, coated with the dust of the day's work. Those who made clever remarks of a warrior working out a puzzle, more often than not I left bleeding in the streets. She smirks and licks her lips as if suddenly thirsty for the savor of blood as well. Soon, though, I discover the pattern. Sai twists the box in her hands as she speaks, pressing points here and there just so. The puzzle box clicked with each deft flick of her fingers, which danced across the surface with a practiced precision. And with each new face I unlocked, the puzzle box told of a new chapter of a story, beginning with a journey into a land where walls were piled high with refuse. As the box twists in her hands, from a distance the surface of the puzzle seems to writhe, as if hundreds of ants were crawling over the smooth gray-green face. With a satisfied nod, Sai Tavakis holds up the puzzle box for all to see, the odd runes now arranged in a clear, distinct line encircling the surface and crawling at a readable pace. Thus continues the tale of the Nameless One. Chapter 27. It's almost embarrassing to write this. I had gotten so used to describing the foul, writhing stench of my surroundings at the beginning of each entry that I now had to pause and readjust myself. Down here in the cooler recesses below the hive, the walls were dry and hard-packed. The air was stale, if not musty. Only the slightest whiff of garbage was in the air. I could have walked into a fresh, clean glade for all I knew. As the door of patchwork wood creaked shut behind me, a dozen pairs of eyes snapped up to look at the new intruder. Collectors. Gutter rats and alley kin. These weren't much like their foolhardy brethren on the surface. No, there was a shiftiness in their eyes. Distrusting of outsiders and careful with their knives. These Burks wouldn't think twice about sliding a dagger between my ribs, but they'd take care to do it out of sight. A ragged middle-aged collector approached as I walked in.
"I..."
He quickly looked us over and then sneered.
"Don't know you."
I narrowed my eyes at him. "I don't believe I've made your acquaintance either." The collector continued to glare at me, standing directly in my path. Trying to walk around him might not have been the best solution. "I'm looking for a man named Farid."
"What you're looking for is no concern of mine, Burke,"
he spat.
"What is concerning me is that you're still breathing in my presence."
Part of me considered threatening to crack his skull, but I thought better of it. If I were really going to show my strengths, I'd shower him in flaming sparks, but then again, that would probably be a little too loud. I stared him down. Collecting bodies before they're dead sounds like a quick way to meet the lady. It seemed to knock some sense into the collector as he turned away from me.
"Watch your back, Cutter. Most here will talk to you with their blade before their bone box, and if you stay much longer, I'll be doing the same."
I snorted. "Whatever." The path through the trash warrens ran down a slight incline, and I was wary of where I stepped. Guided by curiosity, I prodded through abandoned shelves and nooks here and there, scavenging for what I thought might be of use. The path was long and winding, and several times we met a dead end and were forced to turn back. After what seemed like hours of exploring, we decided to take a rest in one of the rag-piled alcoves. I took this opportunity and turned to Dakon. There was little I knew of our new companion, and I was hoping to change that if we were to journey together. "Dakon?" The pale Githzerai turned to me, his eyes like polished coal. His blade mirrored his eyes for a moment as I addressed him, then he nodded.
"What is your will?"
"There are things I would know, Dakon." His voice creaked like an ancient tree on a windy night.
"I will hear you."
I had seen the man in action, casting bolts of furious light that devastated all that they struck. "Can I talk to you about your teachings? Can you teach me anything of the art, Dakon?" I asked of my fellow mage. He paused, considering.
Know that the way of the people is not the same as the art as you have come to know. It is not the energy that gives strength. It is knowing the self that gives strength. The teachings of Xerthamon speak of such things.
I nodded, digesting his words. Would you teach me the way of Xerthamon, Dakon?
Do you know what you have asked?
The texture of Dakon's blade flowed until it became a stone. He raised his eyebrows warily, as if skeptical of whether he should teach me.
To walk the path of Xerthamon, you must know of the people. The knowing of such things by one not of the people is a difficult matter. There are those not of the people who have heard the way of Xerthamon, but they do not know the way.
I mulled over. If this journey was as abstract as Dakon implied, I must prepare to seek the deeper truths in what he has to offer. Dakon, I want to know of the people and know Xerthamon's teachings. I believe there is wisdom to be learned in such things. He inclined his head.
Know that I have heard your words, and I shall test them. To learn, you must know the people. To know the people, you must know the unbroken circle of Xerthamon.
Dakon held up the stone disk in his possession, and his spider-like fingers hooked into its sides. Often I had seen him meditating over it, mulling over the words with a steely gaze. He had read through them thoroughly before. The man had never needed to mouth the words as he read. There was a click from the object, and the plates of the circle slid into a new configuration. He reversed the motion, sealing the stone.
Know the first circle of Xerthamon is open to you. Study it, then I will hear your words.
The small round stone was cool in my hands. The unbroken circle of Xerthamon. I marveled at it, holding the strange mechanical tome carefully, lest I break it. Wouldn't that be a nice thing, cracking the sacred scripture of my new companion and teacher? It was made up of a series of interlocking circles that folded out from one another. The complexity of the plates and the intricacy of their links proved the text was constructed by a master artisan. I mirrored the motions that Dakon made upon the circle, and the plates gave way at my touch, the rings sliding into a new configuration. Upon the rings were a series of symbols. The script was like no writing I had ever seen. It was just a series of interlocking geometries with circles predominating. Yet, just looking at it, I knew the symbols, and I knew I could read them. I looked at it over as we walked.
Know that we are the first people. Once all was chaos. The first people were thought drawn from chaos. When the first people came to know themselves, they were chaos no longer, and became flesh. With their thoughts and knowing of matter, the people shaped the first world and dwelled there, with their knowing to sustain them. Yet the flesh was new to the people, and with it the people came not to know themselves. The flesh gave rise to new thoughts, greed and hate, pain and joy, jealousy and doubt. All of these fed on each other, and the minds of the people were divided. In their division, the people were punished. The emotions of the flesh were strong. The greed and hate, the pain and joy, the jealousy and doubt. All of these served as a guiding stone to enemies. In becoming flesh, the first people became enslaved to those who knew flesh only as tools for their will. No, these beasts were the Illithids. The Illithids were a race that had come not to know themselves. They had learned how to make other races not know themselves. They were the tentacled ones. They lived in flesh and saw flesh as tools for their will. Their blood was as water, and they shaped minds with their thoughts. When the Illithids came upon the people were a people no more. the people became slaves. The Illithids took the people from the first world and brought them to the false worlds. As the people labored upon the false worlds, the Illithids taught them the way of the flesh. Through them the people came to know loss. They came to know suffering. They came to know death, both of the body and mind. They came to know what it is to be the herd of another and have their flesh consumed. They came to know the horror of being made to feel joy in such things. The unbroken circle is the knowing of how the people lost themselves and how they came to know themselves again.
I turned to Dakon when I finished. I have read The Unbroken Circle of Xerthamon. I want to speak to you more about the Way of Xerthamon. He nodded somberly, his coal gray eyes rigid.
What did you come to know?
I was careful in choosing my words. Strength lies in knowing oneself. I learned that once someone does not know themselves, they are lost. They become tools for others. He gazed at me for a long moment, then nodded in the satisfaction of a mentor who has done his duty.
You have come to know the first circle of Xerthamon. You not only see the words of Xerthamon, you have come to know them.
Dakon held up the circle and hooked his fingers around the edges. There was a click, and the plates of the circle slid into a new configuration. He reversed the motion as before, sealing the stone.
Know the second circle of Xerthamon is open to you. Study it, then I will hear your words.
As before, I slid the plates into the configuration Dakon showed me, and a new ring was revealed. The ring carried the same script as I had read before, with the same geometries.
Know that flesh cannot mark steel. Know that steel may mark flesh. In knowing this, Xerthamon became free. Know that the tentacled ones were of flesh. They relied on the flesh and used it as tools for their will. One of the places where flesh served their will was the field of husks on the false world of the Illithids. The fields were where the bodies of the people were cast after the Illithids had consumed their brains. When the brain had been devoured, the husks came to be fertilizer to grow the poison-stemmed grasses of the Illithids. Xerthamon worked the fields with no knowing of himself or what he had become. He was a tool of flesh, and the flesh was content. It was upon these fields that Xerthamon came to know the Scripture of Steel. During one of the turnings, as Xerthamon tilled the fields with his hands, he came upon a husk whose brain remained within it. It had not been used as food, yet it was dead. The thought that one of the husks had died a death without serving as food for the Illithids was a thought Xerthamon had difficulty understanding. From that thought came a desire to know what had happened to the husk. Embedded in the skull of the husk was a steel blade. It had pierced the bone. Xerthamon realized that that was what had killed the husk. The steel had marked the flesh, but the flesh had not marked the steel. Xerthamon took the blade and studied its surface. In it he saw his reflection. It was in the reflection of the steel that Xerthamon first knew himself. Its edge was sharp, its will the wearer's. It was the blade that would become to raise against Gith when Xerthamon made the pronouncement of two skies. Xerthamon kept the blade for many turnings, and many were the thoughts he had about it. He used it in the fields to aid his work. In using it, he thought about how it was not used. The Illithids were powerful. Xerthamon had believed that there was nothing that they did not know. Yet the Illithids never carried tools of steel. They only used flesh as tools. Everything was done through flesh, for the tentacled ones were made of flesh, and they knew flesh. Yet steel was superior to flesh. When the blade had killed the husk, it was the flesh that had been weaker than the steel. It was then that Xerthamon came to know that flesh yielded to steel. In knowing that, he came to know that steel was stronger than the Illithids. Steel became the scripture of the people. Know that steel is the scripture by which the people came to know freedom.
I slid the plate closed, breathing a sigh and meditating over the lesson, seeking out the deeper meaning behind the tale. With the Githzerai, history and parable flowed as one, just as Dakon was one with his Kerak blade. Dakon's gaze was serene.
What did you come to know?
I learned that not knowing something can be a tool, just like flesh and steel, if upon encountering it, you attempt to know its nature and how it came to be. Again, he nodded in satisfaction, a hint of contentment in his eyes.
You have seen the words and you have seen beyond them. You have come to know the second circle of Xerthamon.
He took the circle, and with a deft motion he twisted one of the links so the plate slid forth, but strangely enough, the stone still appeared intact. He handed the plate to me.
Meditate upon this teaching, and the knowing of it shall give you strength. When you have absorbed it, you shall know more.
I read the slim plate, scribed with those circular runes of the Githzerai language. The scripture of steel. It was a spell, one of a form I was unfamiliar with. Its powers drew from the meditative calm of knowing, so different from the rituals of Mebith's recipes. I looked over the chants, the three thoughts of the ritual. Though alien, the words quickly melded together as one, just as the script of Mebith's recipe cards did, just as the circular runes of the Githzerai language did. With a haunting familiarity, I then knew the scripture of steel. I blinked, and Dakon looked on, his calm, stony face unsurprised at the efficiency with which I absorbed the teaching. I would still know more of Xerthamon's teachings. Dakon's fingers felt around the edges of the stone circle, and he twisted it clockwise, the links clicking until they had settled into a new configuration. He then reversed the motion, resetting the stone.
The next circle of Xerthamon is open to you. Study it, then I will hear your words.
I nodded. I'll look it over when the time is right.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. By the end of that, my voice was getting pretty damn hoarse, so these chapters with the circles of Xerthamon are going to be hell on my vocal cords, I can tell already, but I think they're some of the best writing in the game, to be honest, and I look forward to doing all of the readings associated with them. That's about all I have for you this week, but I did want to mention that if you, for whatever reason, are hungry for more content from the Myriad Truths Project, this past weekend over the Memorial Day break, I did a Let's Play of a new video game that came out recently called Detroit: Become Human. I enjoyed it very much, so if you would like to take a look at that Let's Play, you can find that link to on my Twitter account, which is @endless_odyssey. And you can find the playlist linked to on the Myriad Truths blog page, which is just myriadtruths.com. So please check that out if you're at all interested. Otherwise, you know, do the usual. Follow the podcast Twitter account @codex_radio and send us your fan letters at codexpodcast@myriadtruths.com. That'll do it. See you guys next week.